The next case is 07-1222 and 1370, Dorothy Lang Executrix versus Holly Hill Motel. Ms. Tufinger.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Emily Supinger. With me today is my co-counsel, Matthew Fellerhoff. Also in the courtroom today is Dorothy Lang and her three children, Robert, Scott, and Beverly. The issue today is whether in a premises liability case, if there's evidence that the defect which caused the injury constituted a violation of administrative code provision, whether that precludes summary judgment under the open and obvious doctrine. And while this court has never decided that issue, I believe that by looking at the case law that this court has already decided, we come to the logical conclusion that the open and obvious doctrine is not applicable in these types of cases. In Armstrong, this court held that under common law, premises liability in a slip and fall case. The property owner owes a duty to warn invitees of hidden or latent defects, and the property owner owes no duty where the defect is open and obvious, as the invitee has the responsibility of protecting themselves, of identifying the danger and protecting themselves accordingly. And this is and the court made it clear in Robinson that this is the common law duty. In Robinson, this court held that where there is a statutory violation of a duty that results in the injury, that the open and obvious doctrine is not going to be applicable, and this issue should go to the jury. If the jury determines that there is no statutory breach, the issue can then be cited under common law negligence principles, and the jury may consider the open and obvious doctrine then, and only then. We're in sort of a middle area between those two lines of cases, and I rely on Chambers for this court's decision that where there is the violation of administrative code provision, it constitutes evidence of negligence. Negligence, by definition, means duty, breach, and proximate cause.
Counsel, you would be asking us then to extend Robinson somewhat to not only include statutes, but to include administrative code violations.
Not exactly. I believe that there is sort of a hybrid between the common law and Robinson, where you're talking about an administrative code provision. Under a statutory breach, we have negligence per se. So the plaintiff has no burden of demonstrating the duty or the breach of the duty. They only have to establish the statutory violation. We're not suggesting that this constitutes negligence per se.
So the fact that there was no handrail, that's what we're talking about here, correct?
Not primarily. What we're talking about is the height of the step. The step over which Mr. Lang tripped was 2.375 inches higher than was permitted by the building code at its lowest point. It actually went up higher at one end. And that is what actually caused him to fall. And there's evidence in the record that it was the height of the step is what caused him to fall.
And the height of the step was a violation of the building code?
Correct. It was 25% higher than what is permitted by the building code.
Was the lack of a handrail a violation?
In the opinion of our expert, yes, it was. And I believe that that is important also, and it's an issue for the jury to also consider. But what we're really focusing on is the fact that the step actually caused the fall. The lack of the handrail at that point prohibited Mr. Lang from having the opportunity to steady himself and arrest his fall.
Was the step built and designed in that fashion, or had it fallen into disrepair such that it created this unusually large step?
It's hard to tell. There is some conflicting testimony. Primarily, the expert that was retained by the builder and the testimony of the builder. The builder claimed, "I didn't build it this way." The expert testified that maybe it had been changed in some fashion over the years. But from the pictures that are in the record, it's apparent that the step was quite old. So it's really hard to tell exactly what happened with the step.
In considering where we court goes in terms of developing the law in this case, does it make a difference in whether the step was built out of specs or whether it fell out of specs?
I don't think for purposes of the plaintiff's case it does. That might be something that is the subject of a third-party claim between the property owner and whoever was responsible for the step. But the property owner has a duty to maintain his property in compliance with the building code. And if the property is not in compliance with the building code for the plaintiff's purposes, I don't believe it matters.
As a practical matter, what does that involve? It means a property owner needs to go around every couple of weeks and check everything out, take a measuring thing to see whether there's a problem? How extensive does this duty become, I guess is my question.
Presumably, the steps wouldn't change in height over every couple of weeks. But I think the property owner does have a responsibility to know what the conditions of their property are. In this case, the step was nearly 10 inches high. In my client's deposition, she testified that after the accident happened, she went and measured the other steps in the motel, and the rest of them were to code. They were 7 inches. This one was unusually high. It should have been evident to the property owner. In fact, the property owner maintained that it was open and obvious to my client, and if it was open and obvious to my client, it should have been open and obvious to the property owner as well.
Was the first step 2.3 inches higher as well?
The first step was actually higher than that. It was, I believe, almost 11 inches high.
So they negotiated that without any problem?
Right.
Okay.
Well, If we reverse, what do we do with the case of Raffalo versus Los Santoville? I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly. The country club case, 1973 case. I don't think you cited it.
I didn't cite it.
Appellee cited it, but I don't think you did.
I don't believe the case is on point, Your Honor. For one thing, Raffalo did not deal with the open and obvious doctrine. The primary issue in Raffalo was once someone has successfully encountered a hazardous condition, they can't then go back on their second approach and say, it was too high, because they've already encountered it successfully.
Doesn't that fit this case? And your response to Justice O'Connor's question was that the first step was higher than even the step over which he fell. So he negotiated that step.
Correct, but he had never negotiated the second step. And I think
Which was lower.
It was a little bit lower, that's true. But it's still, the first step was from the parking lot up to the riser, and the second step was from the riser up to the porch of the motel. They were different, and maybe one would expect something different when walking from the parking lot to the riser. It's hard to tell. I don't think that is dispositive of this case, because he had never negotiated that second step prior to the fall.
There's no allegation that there was any problem with lighting or weather or any circumstances that would have contributed to any condition that would have, contributed to visibility or perception.
Well, we argued this on whether or not it was actually open and obvious below. It was the evening, but there weren't any. It wasn't raining. The weather wasn't bad.
And the lights were all on.
Yes, I mean, it was still at night in a parking lot, but there wasn't any evidence that the steps weren't visible. I mean, the Langs knew that they were getting ready to walk up steps. Now, whether or not the height of the step was discernible as opposed to visible is a different issue, I think. And that goes back to the importance of the Ohio Basic Building Code and the fact that it puts in these standards for a reason. And one of those reasons is to provide uniformity so that people know what they're dealing with when they encounter steps and things of that nature.
Which gets to the idea of duty and what the property owner has to do with respect to the code. I want to get back to that one of the first questions about the handrail. You had stated something about your expert thought. So this, I'm assuming that the step, the height of the step is specifically mentioned in the code. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, is the handrail, is there a specific section that would deal with the handrail in this case?
There are specific code provisions regarding the handrail. With regard to the handrail, my expert and the expert for the builder disputed whether or not it was required and to what extent it was required. But with regard to the step, the expert for the builder did not dispute that the height of the step exceeded the building code. He didn't actually have an opinion on it, but he said, whatever our expert said, he's right.
And what you're seeking here is really to go to the jury with all of this anyway.
Correct.
Counsel, I want to try to think through the factual permutations of this case, however we write it. You said that, first of all, since this is a step, and I assume it's not from gravel or something like that, so someone constructed something that was specifically in violation of the code, right?
Correct.
This is not something that wear and tear caused.
It right? did not appear so.
Right. But what I want to take it to is, I think you made the statement, or maybe it came from the bench, that the building code requires that you stay within the code after the construction is complete. Are you sure of that?
No, that is not what I meant to say. That the building code applies to the time that
the construction
was constructed.
Right. It has to be built to code, in compliance with the code. If it, due to the hazards of time, falls out of compliance, that's an entirely different matter.
And I think that is a ripe issue for the jury to determine in that case, that the defendant could put on evidence that it was built to code.
You're not suggesting that we write something that says you've got to be forever in compliance with the code, regardless of things that may change. I mean, we've all gone up steps of all kinds that are worn just from they're uneven, just from, you can tell from the wear and tear.
Correct.
Correct. And you're not saying that the code requires.
No, not at all.
At least not this code.
No, not at all.
Right.
At this point, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, unless there are any other questions at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Supinger. Mr. Carson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Herman Carson, along with Beth Ferrier, represent one of the appellees, Holly Hill Motel, Inc. This case puts before the court two longstanding matters of public and judicial policy, the open and obvious doctrine and the use of summary judgment to take cases off the docket, for lack of a better term, where there are not tribal issues to present to a jury. Here, it's undisputed, we believe, from the record, that the condition was open and obvious. There was nothing that prevented the Langs from observing this step. It was actually a pair of single steps. If you look at the pictures in the record, it would be as though I were to step up onto this step to my left and then I would walk almost the length to the bench before stepping up the second step onto the porch.
Counsel, just thinking about the facts and thinking about Armstrong was the case where the rail for the carts, wasn't it, at the store?
Right.
Right. In some ways, steps, to me, would be more obvious than a little rail down at the ground right in front of where you would maybe try to duck into a store, that you can see steps. You know, that's what you're about to encounter, are steps.
Yes.
And I think I dissented in Armstrong, and I thought factually you should get beyond summary because that seemed to be a trip hazard that they put right out in the front of the store. Steps aren't there to be a trip hazard. They're to assist in access. However, the flip side of that is that due to the building code, we're all sort of trained that this is about how much you have to pick up your foot to navigate a step. And when you make that 3 inches higher than the building code, while it's in one sense open and obvious, the actual deviation from what is expected wouldn't be so obvious. It's open, but perhaps not so obvious.
Well, we would submit, Mr. Justice Pfeiffer, that part of the open and obvious is what would be, it's an objective test of the ordinary person, that as you approach steps, and you may very well be correct, I think, that instinctually we may think that steps are going to be so high and uniform as we go up them. But the ordinary and prudent person would, as they approach those steps, look at them to see what they are encountering. Well, not just as to the step, but whether there might be water or some liquid or
what
something.
What I think in our common experience that we see and observe from an open and obvious standpoint are steps where the riser isn't as deep as you would expect, that the steps are very narrow. And that sort of puts your brain on notice, be careful, because they aren't as deep as one would expect, whether or not we know the building code, and presumably nobody has in their head 7 inches versus 10. But the height is, that's less easily discernible, isn't it?
In a given case, I believe so, Your Honor, that would be correct. And I think that if you had a series of them and they fluctuated, that would be a much different situation as to whether it's open and obvious that they aren't uniform. Here, as referenced in a couple points so far, it's a single step for all practical purposes at the juncture of where these events occurred. When the Langs were about ready to go up onto the patio or the porch.
And is there any indication so far as the facts are not fully developed at this point in this case, but was there any indication that the differential is due to the passage of time rather than of construction, original construction that violated the code?
No, Your Honor, there was no evidence. There is one passage in Mr. McCorkle's deposition where in looking at a picture, he makes a reference, and this is to paraphrase it, that's not what I recall them looking like when we finished the job, for lack of a better term. And my recollection is he makes reference, it looks like there may be an overlay of concrete on there, which if that were true, that there's been an additional overlay added, you would have actually decreased the height of the riser on the step because you've thickened the pad or the sidewalk that you were approaching.
Well, I've taken you over to the facts. Let's let you get back to the law.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, before you do, I'd like to ask a question about the facts. It's been, if we have one step, does that mean that they went from a level to a step, then to the next level, where what they referred to as the, I don't know what your words are, the entryway into the...
Yes, Your Honor, they went from, if I'm standing in the parking lot and this to my right here is a step that they stepped up onto from the parking lot, and then they proceeded towards the motel room, and at roughly where your bench is would be the small porch or patio in front of the rooms. There was where you encountered the second step. And so it's flat surface to flat surface, walk on a flat surface, and step from flat surface up to flat surface.
So when they made the step, then they were up on the level of the door?
They
into the room, that would have been
They would have been, Your Honor, although I think when you got to the door, maybe you had, you know, like 2 inches or just a standard, you know, entranceway type situation, but not what would be considered another step.
Counsel, would you have a very different case if that first step hadn't been negotiated, if it wasn't even there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that what the first step illustrates probably more importantly is that there are no attendant circumstances. The lighting is sufficient. You can see the step. You can negotiate it. I don't know that it changes where we're at factually or legally on it. Its primary importance is that it shows we had sufficient lighting and that we're not talking as to where this actually occurred, some insurmountable difference or height, because they were able to negotiate successfully the first step.
Does it go to notice as far as the, you know, the open and obvious? I mean, there seems to have been thought expressed here that you know when you're ascending a stair that is not quite right, that it doesn't feel like the other stairs that may comport with code. I'm not so sure that that's accurate, but you know, I'm thinking that if the first step was negotiated successfully without any attendant circumstances, how does that play with open and obvious?
As I understand your question,
does it put them on notice? Does it put the Langs on notice that there's something a little unusual here? Maybe we better, you know, pay a little more attention, or is it not?
I don't know that it requires heightened attention, so much so as it shows that it is not obstructed, that it is open and obvious to them, if I'm understanding the question.
Well, if something's open and obvious, you're going to have heightened attention, so you're not going to trip on it or hurt yourself on it. Isn't that, if it's open and obvious, it's a notice to the individual, deal with it, pay attention, and don't, and if you don't, well, it's not the owner's fault, but it is a signal to invitees to do something a little differently.
Correct, and I guess I was fixated on your use of heightened attention, that you are to use sufficient attention. I guess I was thinking more of alarm or alertness when you used that word on it. I'd agreed for Mr. Carlino.
We're really talking about the issue of duty, though, are we not? Isn't that what we're talking about?
Correct, Your Honor.
How does our decision in Chambers versus St. Mary impact your position?
Well, Your Honor, there, open and obvious was not before the court at all.
I understand, but didn't we hold there that a party may not use the violation of an administrative code section to establish negligence per se, but it could function as evidence of negligence?
Correct, sir, and I
so
think
if we if we have the violation of the building code with respect to the height of the riser as evidence of negligence, how does that directly impact, then, the open and obvious defense with respect to the duty element?
I don't think that it directly impacts it, Your Honor, because it is still open and obvious. I think that Chambers...
Your view is, if it's open and obvious, that precludes application of the violation serving as negligence, as evidence of negligence.
I think there's a distinction between evidence of negligence and being negligent. If it were, let's say it was that the floor joists were the wrong width on
center. Let's say it's 2 3/4 inches too high.
What the step is?
Right, the riser.
Right, okay. Our position is that it's open and obvious. That obviates the duty.
So there can be no duty whatsoever, and the court should handle that as a matter of law.
Correct, Your Honor.
So, counsel, you're saying that a building violation, a building code violation, would be insulated, the owner would be insulated from any type of liability as long as it's obvious to someone?
Correct. That he is not the insurer of the safety of everybody. He's not the insurer of compliance with all the multitude of building code violations where the condition is open and obvious.
So you're saying that this is not like Robinson, which is a statutory duty. You don't see the building code rising to that level. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, Your Honor. I think that the court was correct and should reaffirm Chambers that this administrative regulation does not rise to a statutory level such as was present in Robinson.
I think we're going to let Mr. Carlino have a
yes,
word.
Yes, that's what.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Mr. Carlino.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Steve Carlino. I represent Roddy McCorkle, DBA McCorkle Builders in this case. With the time left, I want to focus on a couple of distinct issues in this case. First, I would like to address the appellant's reliance upon the Robinson case and distinguish it to Chambers and the facts here. Second, time providing, I would like to discuss a little bit about the Chambers decision and its application by the various appellate courts. With respect to the first issue, appellates want this court to extend the Robinson decision to apply not only to violations of statute, but also violations of administrative code regulations. In Robinson, evidence was presented that the defendant landlord had violated the Landlord-Tenant Act, the duty to repair. The court held that the landlord breached that duty and that it was constituted negligence per se. The reason Robinson cannot be extended here is due to the fact that when we go back and look at Chambers, Chambers was very clear to say violation of administrative code regulation does not equate to a violation of statute. The court was very clear to and went to great lengths in Chambers to discuss and elucidate upon the material differences between a statute and an administrative code regulation. So if this court were to rule evidence of a building code violation obviates a premises owner or occupier's ability to have the court also look at the open and obvious doctrine, it would be doing exactly what it set out to avoid doing in Chambers. Being bestowing upon administrative agencies the ability to propose and adopt rules which alter the proof requirements between litigants.
Well, counsel, the suggestion was that the violation is some evidence of negligence.
Right,
and not per se.
Right, and we think that there's a good middle ground perspective, and this goes to the second issue about how the various appellate courts have applied the Chambers decision. We believe Francis, which is one of the cases appellants rely on, got it somewhat wrong. They said, okay, there's a building code violation, it's evidence of negligence, and they treated it as if it was evidence or negligence per se. They said, we're going to go to the jury on proximate cause. Chambers only stands for the proposition that violations of administrative rules can only be evidence of negligence, not negligence per se.
But I don't, is the appellant here asking for negligence per se? I thought they were just asking.
I think,
to get past summary.
Right, but I think that there can be application and consideration of a building code violation, and that's not mutually exclusive to the trial court also taking into account whether or not that violation is in and of itself open and obvious. Obviously, with the limited time here, I'm not going to reference all the appellate decisions, but I think the one that got it right and treated it with the best interplay between these two issues was Oliver versus Leaf and Vine, which was the second district decision. Ultimately, they said that we can look at evidence to see what the building code violation is and then determine if that building code violation is, in fact, open and obvious. I think what Mr. Carson started out saying was a good point. We can have building code violations that are hidden and concealed, that are not open and obvious, such as you may not have enough floor joists under the floor comes undone, somebody gets injured. But the steps—
Well, but that wouldn't, the open and obvious doctrine wouldn't be in play at all.
That's correct. I mean, so we're saying that there are situations where you have a building code violation that we believe is open and obvious, and the trial court can balance the two together. they can look at that building code violation and they can say, is that building code violation open and obvious? Obviously, we are going to have situations where we are going to have violations of a building code where it's simply not open and obvious.
What you're arguing, though, is that those latent defects are not subject to the open and obvious rule, and all the ones that are open and obvious, the open and obvious rule will trump the building code violation.
I understand what you're saying, but again, I think a close.
Well, I thought that's what you were saying.
Well, in
what are you saying?
in Oliver, sure. For example, I think they got it right. I think they said it very well. What they said was that in looking at Chambers, it implied that building code violations may be considered in light of the circumstances, including whether the violation is open and obvious. So the Oliver court went on to state that a condition violates a building code may support the conclusion that the condition was dangerous and the landowner breached its duty. But they said if the violation was open and obvious, the open and obvious nature would obviate the duty to warn. So there's definitely an inquiry that a trial court has to make. They have to look at the building code violation and the evidence of the building code violation, but they also need to look at whether it's open and obvious. We believe the facts here in Lange are such that we lacked a handrail. There was no handrail. The fact that you had to negotiate the height of the steps, while for purposes of summary judgment we conceded those issues, we argued that those two alleged violations were in and of itself open and obvious and allows the trial court to balance those two things and make that determination.
So the more that you can see of the building code violation, the more you may not have the owner being liable for any injury that you...
Right. I mean, there definitely are going to be situations where the building code violation is hidden and concealed. But it goes back to the entire purpose of open and obvious, which is that the invitee has the same information, the same amount of notice that the building owner has.
But doesn't the test that you just announced or urged us to adopt place the trial court in the role of deciding facts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes to the point that this court, even in Armstrong versus Best Buy, upheld that open and obvious is an issue of law for the court to take a look at. And so what we're dealing with...
So it doesn't really, excuse me, but it doesn't really matter then for purposes of summary judgment whether there's a building code violation.
Well, it does. I mean, it takes us back to the distinction made in Chambers and the distinction made in Robinson, which is... The whole point is we're not going to change proof litigants between, or the proof requirements between the parties. Because an administrative code violation is not negligence per se, it still allows the trial court to apply common law principles when looking at the facts and evidence, including the application of the open and obvious doctrine.
You've used your time, Mr. Carlino.
Thank you.
Ms. Stubinger, you saved a little more than 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's take a case where there is no building code violation, but there is negligence on the part of the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
But the condition is open and obvious. Does the negligence obviate the open and obvious, or does the open and obvious still stand?
I think Armstrong is still good law on that issue, that if it's open and obvious, the property owner does not owe a duty to the plaintiff to warn them of the danger.
So even in a common law setting where there is negligence, if the condition is still open and obvious, there's no violation.
Correct, and I believe that's what Armstrong
said. And why is that different then? If we've said that building codes are not the equivalent of statutory negligence per se, they're just evidence of negligence, why then doesn't the same common law principles of negligence apply? If it's open and obvious, you have a duty on your own to navigate.
I believe it's because the administrative body with the expertise in this area has determined what the minimum safety requirements of the state are going to be, and that those requirements have been widely accepted throughout the state. Many jurisdictions have adopted the building code by reference as the law in their community.
But we've said, but that's almost equating it then back to
right.
Negligence per se, and we've said it's mere negligence, and mere negligence under Best Buy doesn't get rid of open and obvious.
I believe it's different, though, because it is evidence of negligence, and that establishes that there was a duty, and there was a breach, and there was proximate cause. And if you have just common law negligence, there is no duty where the defect is open and obvious. The open and obviousness of...
So you're creating a special status for building code violations different from common law negligence in open and obvious.
And I believe that's what Chambers says. By creating that category, we have to treat it a little bit differently.
I don't recall Chambers saying that. All I recall Chambers saying is it's not per se, it's only evidence of negligence, not some special category.
Okay.
You want a special category created.
I believe that when you have the building code, there is an additional layer that we have to look at. There's a foreseeable risk of harm to the plaintiff because it violates the minimum safety code provisions in the state. I want to also address the issue of whether or not the fact that the first step was successfully negotiated put the plaintiff on notice. There are photographs in the record, and we have to be careful because there's actually two sets, one as the steps existed when they fell and others that were taken by the expert for the builder, at which point the steps have been completely torn out and replaced. But if you look at the pictures from when the Langs fell, the steps are very different. The first step actually looks a little more hazardous than the first one. It steps up from the parking lot onto the riser. The second step looks like a normal step that you would encounter every single day. So I don't think that the fact that the first step was successfully negotiated would put the Langs on notice that the second step would also be in violation of the building code or would be abnormally high. So. No.
Getting this case to the jury could still, I mean, looking at the merits of the case, could still weigh the responsibility of the plaintiff, for example, to take care of himself. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think that issue on whether or not it was readily ascertainable would be an element of comparative negligence as opposed to open and obvious.
So that's why, I mean, looking at the procedure here, we're talking about whether this case should continue on to the jury in a circumstance such as this.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Zupinger.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised our opinion. We'll take a brief recess. Thank you.
Thank you.